Preparing to delve in 3, 2, 1.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Delve. My name is Nathan.
And I'm Alex.
And Alex, do you feel like we cooperate well together?
Sometimes.
Well, good news. We don't have to worry too much about that today. On the program, we have an expert in cooperative gaming, Matt Leacock. Matt, thank you so much for being on the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's terrific. I think people are fairly familiar with your work, but if not, you've done some games. Let's see, there was the Forbidden Island and Pandemic. And I think a lot of people have played those. They're all over the place. I wanted to say, I actually got a chance to play those with people who are usually pretty reluctant to try new games. And they were really interested in the concept of a cooperative experience. They were always used to very adversarial ones. And so they really enjoyed that. And I enjoyed it as well. But I had never really seen any games like that. And so I was kind of wondering what drew you to that type of game.
Yeah, like yourself, I didn't think cooperative games would be any fun at all when I first heard about them. I kind of thought they were things that you'd like try to teach kids how to share and care, or you know, really, really dry educational experiences. Mm-hmm. Until I played Reiner Knizia's Lord of the Rings, and I was really taken with that game and how he with simple mechanisms got people fighting against Sauron, and you know, it was a very emotional experience. And I didn't think, you know, a simple cardboard artificial intelligence could do that kind of thing. So I was kind of hooked on the idea of co-op games from that point on.
Was it always your intention to make cooperative games when you started designing?
No, Pandemic was just one game of many. I tried to get a lot of games designed and published. My ultimate goal was just to get a single game published. Really, I wanted to get something out.
Just the one.
So Pandemic actually took off, and so that opened up a lot of doors. But the cooperative thing was kind of an accident. It turned out, though, that I really do enjoy designing them. They're kind of a fun little puzzle to crack. You have to kind of figure out how to write a computer program in a sense, using a deck of cards.
Right. Now, was Pandemic the first game you made?
No, I made a lot of really terrible games before.
Okay.
I think Nathan meant to ask, is Pandemic the first game that you published?
I self-published a couple. I don't know if those really count. It was like 100 or 200 copies, you know, like off my printer. It was the first time I worked with a publisher and got something really
right.
Into them.
Apparently you did well then, because everybody and their brother knows about Pandemic, so.
Yeah, I feel like I got right game at the right time. Right. I was very happy that it took off.
On the topic of Pandemic, actually, I wanted to ask, why did you want me to be so terrified of infectious diseases? I played that game and I'm like, oh, we are doomed.
Yeah, I guess there's two parts. I mean, one of the diseases are fun to model because they're uncaring, unthinking little things that have these horrible chain reactions and like emergent behaviors, and they're scary, and everybody can kind of get behind fighting them. It's not like, you know, it's like all of humanity can get together to beat those things. But I picked them out because I thought they would have fun emergent properties. You know, a simple rule set could lead to some pretty dramatic outcomes.
It certainly does. I think that probably more people have wound up with an entire world of just infectious diseases than actually cured them. I'm not sure. When you started, did you find that the ratio was pretty much 50-50 success failure, or was it pretty sided to one or the other?
Oh, I wanted to make the game challenging so that you'd play it and get your butt kicked, and then you want to, you know, right, fight back again and try again. So I didn't have a specific ratio in mind, but I didn't want people playing it right away. And you know, the worst thing would be you'd play it, you'd win, you go like, okay, what's next? You know, what should we play next? I wanted people to really get engaged and feel like if they lost, winning was just out of reach and that they had to try again and next time they'd get it.
I was going to say, it seems you did well on that because people come back for more. They're like, oh, we lost the game. This disease killed everybody. And now we've got to try again. And I I did notice. I think I watched the tabletop they played where they did it on the Legendary.
Oh, whatever. Yeah. We'll pick Legendary, I think, probably to keep it under the 45-minute time cap. But yeah, that's ridiculous. You don't play Legendary with a group of not a good plan.
Was that kind of one of your intents for being a more difficult but not unattainable, just like have different levels of difficulty for play so people can play as they choose?
Yeah, you want to get players in a nice flow state where they feel like success, like I said, is just within their grasp or maybe at their fingertips. And so like the ideal game for me would be that you win or you lose on like the last turn of the last action. You know, it just, I was looking for that kind of drama.
Right. Just grasping at the very last straw and hopefully just making it out by the skin of your teeth.
Yeah, and if you win it, then you can bump up the difficulty the next time you play.
If Indiana Jones is able to actually escape the boulder, try to get him like a few feet back the next time. Exactly. See if he can make it through the next. You did mention that there were some terrible games that you made before. Can you kind of give me an idea of what those games were or what you were thinking of with those?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just natural that, you know, when you're doing any kind of creative endeavor, you have to hack at it for a while before you build up a set of skills that, you know, ultimately you can start making quality work. I read someone was talking about poetry and how everybody's got to write 200 bad poems before they can write a good poem. And I think it's probably similar with games. So, I mean, I started out the way a lot of people do. I made, you know, crappy roll and move games as a kid, or I modded games that I got for my birthday, or would try to make a better game on the back of the game board. So I had one game where I took a game that was based on Space Invaders with absolutely no decisions whatsoever in it, and turned that into a game where you run around and you mine asteroids for ore and sell it at market and that kind of thing.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but they're all over the board. I mean, I had like fantasy adventure type games. I tried to make a fantasy war game, which was sprawling and horrible after playing a lot of Avalon Hill war games. I wanted to make my own.
Right.
It was all over the board.
Did you ever try to take like Monopoly and try to improve the rules on the back?
I did. Yeah. I made a center board, I think, and you could like invest in oil wells and other things. I can't the kind of property. Yeah, instead
like
of going around past go, you went into the center, and then there's another loop in there with other types of stuff.
Ooh.
Yeah. I probably played twice or something, you know.
It wouldn't necessarily just be a racetrack. You could like take the inner path too.
Yeah, something like that.
That's interesting. So you get a little bit more player choice. They should make that game.
I think he did.
Not sure that's true.
Do we really need more Monopoly games, though?
No, there's so many versions as it stands. You're right. Never mind. In terms of development, since your antagonist is the game itself instead of the players, how does that actually change the development of game mechanics?
For me, it makes it easier because I can test it a lot simpler. I can set up a little experiment, basically, and create an AI rule set and then just try it out on my own. Because you imagine playing chess with yourself, it's difficult because you have to kind of change viewpoints every time you shift seats. Mm-hmm. With a cooperative game, that's less of a problem because everybody's on the same side. Unless you got sort of a hidden traitor where it would be really difficult to play, I think, and solo. So for me, I can iterate on a game a lot faster because I can kind of do a lot of solo testing before I start exposing it to other people.
I see. So like what is really different about trying to create basically the adversarial relationship rather than have the players be the adversaries themselves?
Oh, wow. I don't know. I'm probably running into the expert problem. I do it so often that I don't know how to describe it because I do more co-op games than competitive games. And so for me, the competitive games are a bit of a difficult thing to handle. I guess with a competitive game, you can rely on the fact that you've got another player to provide the intelligence and you're just kind of setting the table with rules and parameters. With a cooperative game, it's really about trying to generate difficult decisions and putting a problem in front of the players that's worthy of their time. And, you know, that's difficult enough, but not too hard. And is generative, you know, every time you play, you want it to be different. So, you know, I've got these different aspects or criteria that I want to make sure I meet every time I develop one of these systems. And then, you know, it's got to be different from my other games, too. I don't want to keep reinventing are reskinning the games. Each variant of Pandemic, for example, I want there to be something different about it, not just a different map.
Is there anything you have to think of, like, with balancing? Like, you're trying to balance the system against the players?
Yeah, certainly. So you want to create, generally speaking, I'm looking to create a long-term goal that the players need to complete in order to win. And then you have to have short-term complications along the way. I like to have people trying to balance short-term goals versus long-term goals. And so, and also sacrifice is another thing. Like, well, we can do this, this, and this, but at the cost of this. So, and that at least allows the trade-offs. And of course, you need all that stuff to be balanced so that it provides the appropriate amount of challenge. Another big thing that I like to bring in is different beats, ebbs and flows of highs and lows, or tension and release, hope and anxiety.
Yes. Yes.
So you can see that in Pandemic with the epidemic cards that come time to time. So the players feel like they kind of get a handle on things after a certain amount of time, and then you have to kind of inject a fresh dose of fear and raise the stakes. And then, you know, so that kind of ebb and flow is a hallmark of good story writing. And I think it also really works well in cooperative games.
Right. When I was playing Pandemic, I noticed a similar thing in Forbidden Island with the flood cards, was that as we kept playing, they kept coming faster and faster. So there was this kind of ramp up as we went along, like, oh, we only have like a couple turns. It's coming. We know it's coming. Thank you for scaring me.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Nathan, you're scared of sharks anyways, so that flood is just going to mess with you.
Yeah. I really wanted to get those relics. They're probably worth a lot on the open market. I don't know. When you were doing playtesting, this is something that interested me. So you're watching everybody play the game. What sort of observations do you take away from that? What are you trying to get out of watching people working together playing your game?
So I can learn a lot from observing people. It's my primary way to do playtesting is really just direct observation. I don't ask a whole lot of questions. It's mostly just watching people. And co-op games are great because everybody's talking to each other all the time. So you can get a lot more out of it than, say, if you're watching like a two-player abstract brain-burning game. Like, watching people play Go, you don't learn a whole lot unless you're looking at their strategy long. It requires a lot of analysis.
Right.
But when I'm watching people play, say, a version of Pandemic or whatnot, I'm looking to see, are they engaged? You know, are they leaning in on the table? Or, God forbid, they're checking their phone. So that's one thing. You know, how is that going? That's generally a good indicator of whether or not the balance is right. If the game is too hard, people get frustrated and exasperated. And if it's too easy, they get really bored. You can find that out right away. Start to check it out.
It's that level of frustration, but not boredom.
Yeah, yeah.
Where it's frustrated enough that you want to keep trying and pushing at it and doing it.
It's a strange thing. You know, when you're watching people and they're bored, they really want the game to be challenging them. But at the same time, they want to win. And so you get this strange kind of reaction from folks. And I've learned to pick up on that when I'm watching it.
It's totally different than Dark Souls, which is just wanting to torture yourself.
Yes. Yes, I can attest. How does communication go into that? Because the players have to do an awful lot of just communicating and strategizing among themselves in Forbidden Island and Pandemic and those games.
Different games have different communication patterns. I like to do full cooperative games, so I don't do a lot of rules that restrict communication. So, unlike Hanabi or other games where there's hidden traitors or whatnot, it's generally pretty much open-ended because I like group collaborative problem solving and all the creativity that brings. And so those are the types of games that I tend to design because I just enjoy playing them more. But yeah, I do look to see what kind of communication is going on, because that's for one thing, you can kind of see what's going on inside people's heads, you know, what they deem is important and what's not. I also look to see what kind of terms they're using to describe all the different elements in the game. Like early on, you might have a really good idea what everything is named and what it stands for. But if your players start calling things by other names or using different verbs for the actions you've got in your game, I've learned to really pay attention, because sometimes I need to recalibrate the language I'm using so it matches what players have in mind.
Has that ever affected like the rule book or the terminology that you use in the end product?
Yeah, if I find people confusing different terms, you know, maybe two terms are too similar, or they just cannot remember something, or they can't pronounce something, you know, I'll go back and make modifications. We have done some historical versions of Pandemic that with some pretty rough place names, which we decided to keep because mispronouncing them can be almost as fun as pronouncing them correctly. So the Dutch place names, I've got some Latin in an upcoming game. It can be quite a challenge.
I see. I have actually not gotten a chance to play Pandemic the Cure, but I heard that was a very different gaming experience. When you get a chance to do like another version of Pandemic like that, are you able to go back and say, well, the game was good, but what if you played it this way?
I guess there's different ways to look at it. I mean, for Pandemic the Cure, it was all about trying to reduce the game into a dice format. And I really do like trying to boil a game down to its essence and see if I can still capture the magic. So if I have opportunities to do that kind of thing, I'm all for it. But I'm trying to understand the nuance of your question. What were you looking for?
Oh, sorry. I was just wondering, like, when you went to Pandemic Cure came after Pandemic, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How long after? Just out of curiosity.
The Cure came out in 2014 and Pandemic came out in 2008. So it's about 6 years after.
Okay. So when you started working on The Cure, were you thinking like, you know, Pandemic worked and people really loved it, but could you take that formula and try something new and fresh with it, like you did with the dice mechanics?
Yeah. I mean, I didn't want it to be just Pandemic with dice. I wanted to see if there's something else I could bring to it. Part of my goal was to try to make the game easier to set up and faster to play. So you'd have, you get it on the table without, you know, shuffling up a deck of cards and setting all that up. So you cut maybe 10 minutes out of setup and 15 minutes out of playtime. So that was one of the goals. But there's also kind of a push your luck mechanism in Pandemic the Cure that's not in the board game. And that, I think, gives it, another reason to play it.
Now, having played those games, I was wondering, was your intention when you made the game to give everybody a role?
No, actually. I mean, when I first started developing Pandemic, everybody was sort of moving three gray pawns collectively around the world together. No one owned any pawn at all. And I was showing it off. This is, maybe about halfway through its development. Showing it off, I think I was pitching it to Days of Wonder at the time. They're just a few miles away from my house, so it was really convenient. And they gave me some feedback that stuck with me that, in retrospect, it seems really obvious that players really want to be kind of embodied in the game. They want to be able to see themselves in the game. And so they challenged me to see if I could figure out some way to do that. And the obvious answer was to just have each player, you know, move their own pawn. It seems so ridiculously obvious now in retrospect, but I thought the system I was designing was kind of fragile. I wasn't sure it was going to work, but it worked just fine. So everybody got their own pawn, and that opened up the ability for them to have their own special powers and abilities, and that led to a lot of differentiation. Allows you to stand out and kind of be special in the game. So that's become a cornerstone of the games.
And the way that it works in the games, everybody is, it's random, the actual role that you get. So it's always different every single time.
Yeah, that's one thing I learned in playtesting is that, if you make the roles more powerful than you think they can be, and then ratchet up the game's difficulty to kind of compensate for that, everybody feels really good because you feel super powerful. And then if you play a role with those superpowers then and you win, you might think, oh, wow, this role is indispensable because you've kind of learned how to win with that role. So if you get dealt role cards and your favorite role is missing, now you have to think about the game in a brand new way. So that was one thing that players really reported enjoying because it brought a fresh, every time you played the game, you had a different combination of roles, different combination of powers, and you had to kind of relearn how to play the game to some extent.
I really liked it because I found when we were playing, it gave everybody the sense that they had a specific purpose in the game.
You get to stand out and have your own kind of reason for being. And you're like, okay, right. I got this. This is what I do. You know, I'm the guy who takes the cubes off the board, or I'm the one who, you know, can cure easier, or that kind of thing.
I really liked that aspect. Even though I was trying to figure out what I was doing, I also had the ability to kind of help other people figure out how their roles actually work as well. So it's nice. It also helps a lot for different experience levels. So somebody who's been playing for a long time can really help and aid somebody who is just starting out. I found that it was a very different feeling around the table than when you're trying to knock other people out of the game. Was that something that you had noticed during playtesting?
Oh, yeah, definitely. That's one of the things that, I mean, I designed the game to play with family, and specifically with my wife. I mean, we'd played cooperative games, and it was substantially different in the way we approached it and how we felt after the game was over. You know, we're all kind of playing together, so, you know, whether we win or lose, it didn't really matter. We just had fun in the experience. And what you mentioned about, you know, new players is really true. They make really good gateway games because you can introduce people to it, and the stakes are really, really low. You're all working together, so you can kind of assist new players as they're coming up to speed.
Now, you had mentioned that you were playing some cooperative games before. Were there any games that really inspired, like, Pandemic?
Yeah, I mentioned before that Lord of the Rings was probably the one that inspired me the most. Yeah, right. I played Shadows Over Camelot, I think, as well, and that might have been it before I had the Pandemic done. Ghost Stories came out around the same time as Pandemic. I hadn't played that before it came out. Yeah, I can't think of any other ones at the time. There have been cooperative games, you know, for quite some time, since the 70s, maybe even before, but they've been a very low percentage of the games on the market. And it's just only the past 10 years or so that they've really started to take off.
Right, absolutely. Now, one question I had about Forbidden Island specifically, what led you to the decision of the card-based layout?
Let's see. So I was actually approached by Game Riot to try to come up with a cooperative game for kids that kind of captured some of the magic of Pandemic. You know, like, can we bottle that up? And so their original brief was to create a cooperative card game. So those tiles that you see on the table used to be cards. And it just turns out the cards are really hard to pick up and flip. So they morphed into tiles. And they were cards because Game Riot just makes a lot of card games. And so that was sort of like their first thing to think of.
Well, see, that makes sense to me. I guess that makes sense. Now, Forbidden Island was before Forbidden Desert, right?
That's right.
When you did Forbidden Desert, what were you looking to change mechanically? I know that some of the mechanics are a little bit different in Forbidden Desert.
Well, a couple things. I wanted to make sure I wasn't just repeating Island. I wanted to bring a new experience to the table. And I didn't want to use the whole... you know, draw a card and reshuffle the deck and put it back on top of the draw pile. I wanted to make sure it was something, some new kind of enemy that you had to deal with. I also worked with the publisher to define the requirements, and we really wanted to make the game a lot harder so that hobby players could have something to really sink their teeth into. And also people who had played Forbidden Island could kind of like graduate to Forbidden Desert. So we really did want to make the game more difficult. So that game just came out of a lot of experimentation, really. I had played a game called, I think it's The Amazing Labyrinth, when I was a teenager, and loved the way the tiles shifted on that. And so I experimented a bit with shifting and, you know, how to represent the storm. And by just simply taking a tile out and having the tiles shift into the empty spot, I was able to kind of like do both.
Right.
So yeah, it was mostly just a lot of experimentation and trying to come up with something that was both different and more difficult.
Yeah. Since you have Forbidden Island and Forbidden Desert, do you have any more plans for the future for more Forbidden places?
Well, I'm glad you asked. Yeah, Forbidden Sky will be coming out this August. So I think it's just over a month away.
This
is the third game in the series, and at the end of Forbidden Desert, you take off in your airship. That you build. You construct it out of the parts that you find in the desert, and it takes you somewhere up in the sky. So we haven't talked about much about what happens up there, but it's another game, and it has some interesting components and mechanisms in it.
Can I load my save game from Forbidden Desert?
I don't know if that's... Well, isn't that kind of indicative anyway? Because at the end of Forbidden Desert, aren't you just trying to get out of the desert? So you'd all be in the plane by that point?
Yeah, right. So in Forbidden Island, you land with your helicopter, right? And you know, if you're successful, you grab all the artifacts and you take off on your helicopter. Then the helicopter crashes in the desert, and you have to, you know, assemble the airship and you take off and then you head to Forbidden Sky. So you can think of it in, I like to think of it as episodes in like an adventure serial.
So from Forbidden Sky, are we going to perhaps get Forbidden Planet? Because that's where my mind went.
There is a very large rocket on the cover of Forbidden Sky, so that may be a little bit of a pointer.
Forbidden Stars.
I think that's been done.
Has it? Probably. It sounded familiar, no. So I went with it. Forbidden Galaxy. Whatever.
Forbidden Planet's been done.
I'll leave the naming up to you.
Okay.
Forbidden Space?
No, just Nathan. We're space. Leaving the naming up to the guy who's making the game.
You know what? That's probably for the best. We do that enough as it stands.
Is there, or are there, any specific mechanics from games you've made, even ones you didn't necessarily publish, that you just think stand out and you'd love to use again for something?
I have a game that I worked on as a teenager where you were subatomic particles, and your goal was actually to split and cause chain reactions in an effort to kind of like melt down the reactor, I think, before your opponent melted down the reactor. It didn't make a whole lot of sense. But what I liked about the game was that it had these exponential chain reactions in it, to the point where, you know, you can imagine a design brief where, you know, if you lost, it would mean that you had to have as many poker chips on the board as there were atoms in the universe. You know, like trying to create massive out of control chain reactions was something I really wanted to try modeling. And that was part of the inspiration for chain reactions in Pandemic. But I'm always interested in those small little behaviors that can add it to something really huge.
So. I like that. Hopefully scaled down from the actual amount of particles in the universe, though.
Yeah, that'd be a very expensive game.
That's a lot.
It would take a long time to play.
That's like more than seven. Yeah, that's a lot.
that's way more. And every particle gets to be a player.
You need 1 to the 10th times 100 chips, please. What?
Cuss that out.
You know what? At that point, it's almost a role-playing game. We'll take on a little role and just build upward from there. I was going to say, I have one more heady question that I had for you. I feel like Forbidden Island and Pandemic, a lot of your games are really games that could be played by any generation, you know, regardless of how old you are in any time period. And I was wondering, what qualities do you think make a game evergreen?
I think there's a number of them. I mean, first and foremost, I think the game's got to be pretty accessible. You got to be able to pull it off the shelf and be able to learn it and teach it without a tremendous amount of overhead. When I'm teaching a game, I always try to get a sense of whether I'm feeling like I need to apologize when I'm teaching rules because they're too long or too convoluted. And if I feel like that, then I know that I have to make a change. If I'm trying to do a gateway game, it helps if everybody's involved throughout the whole thing and engaged. So having a large degree of player interaction is important, and trying to minimize downtime. I think you have to be pretty sensitive to the duration of the game. So there aren't any wildly successful, popular mass market games that go over, say, an hour. Mm-hmm. There are some exceptions, you know, Monopoly can go really long, but at the time, I think there wasn't a whole lot of competition for it.
True.
So, you know, you look at, those are some of the big ones. Accessibility, duration, engagement are big. And then, you know, you want a pretty well put together product. So the product design's got to be, you know, when I'm talking about like the illustration and the overall packaging and shelf presence and all that is sort of a prerequisite as well. Right. But even if you got all that stuff put together, you absolutely no guarantee of success. So I think you also have to be really lucky and have the right product at the right time, you know, when the market's ready for it. Yeah. And that's really difficult to predict.
I was actually watching something not too long ago where they explained that actually we've been playing Monopoly wrong the entire time. It's not supposed to go endlessly like that. You're
you should be able to finish it in about 75 minutes. Yeah.
If you actually played the rules as they were intended originally, then it's actually a much quicker and kind of more brutal game than just stockpiling land and hotels. It wasn't really supposed to be like that. But then everyone was like, I want an empire. I feel like, you know, you don't have to worry too much about that when you're playing like a Pandemic, because the game goes, okay, no, you don't have time. You don't have time to build an empire here. You have to keep moving. So
yeah,
so,
you're gonna run out of time. You're gonna have like I think 26 turns or something is the maximum in Pandemic, just because the player deck runs out. So yeah, there's a cap.
Is that even on the lowest difficulty?
I don't have the numbers in front of me, but it's something that's funny.
It's I didn't even think about that there would be a finite number of turns I could. I was always hoping that maybe I could game the system enough that I could get over that point. And you had already mentioned Forbidden Sky, but is there anything else in the works that you can talk about?
Let's see. We have another Pandemic survival series game. So I put out a game every year set in a different country where the Pandemic World Championship is held. And this year it'll be in Italy. So the game is tied thematically to Italy in some way.
Oh.
So that's coming out in November. I'm trying to think what else is coming. Forbidden Sky, I mentioned. Mm-hmm. And I think that's all I can talk about. I've got at least somewhere between a half dozen and a dozen games in development at various stages. So there's more coming. Just can't quite talk about it.
Talk about it yet. Yeah. And I didn't realize there was a Pandemic World Championship. How long has that been going on?
I think this is a fourth year. The championship was held in Germany and then Spain and then the Netherlands, and this year it'll be in Italy.
So it's actually rewarding to try and stop viruses.
It's quite a spectacle watching the different teams. So it's teams of two that are competing against each other to be the first team to either find the four cures or to be the last team still surviving.
And they're
all playing with a duplicate setup, so it's like duplicate bridge but with a Pandemic.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because when I heard World Championship and I thought cooperative gaming, I thought to myself, is it can the game actually win the championship itself? I don't know if that's possible.
Yeah, that hasn't happened yet.
No. Well,
just wait.
There's still time.
We have seen it where it's the last group that survived. We just don't make them play until they all die.
Oh, okay. Fair enough.
Nathan, you did know there were different seasons for it, right?
I did know there were other seasons. I didn't know that there was a championship that they played.
Yeah. When you're talking about seasons, are you talking about Pandemic Legacy?
I think so.
Yeah, so those are different things. So the Pandemic Championship is the base game, and then we've got Pandemic Legacy. And I guess I can tell you that we're working on season 3 for that. Season 2 came out last October. And Rob Daviau and I are very busy at work on season 3.
Excellent. And then in the future, there's like a dozen or so other things, but you know, that's down the road. It'd be spoilers. We don't want that.
I'd just say keep an eye out for Forbidden Sky. Do at your local retailer in August.
Excellent. I will be looking forward to it. Matt, thank you so much for coming on the show and answering all of our questions, regardless of how confusing they were. thank you so much for making time for us.
Of course. Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We will be looking forward to Forbidden Sky, and I will continue trying to survive the horrible diseases that are coming for me.
Very good.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Matt.
Thanks.
All right. And there you have it, everybody. That was our interview with Matt Leacock. Yes, that actually happened. So yay us. We will be looking forward to more Forbidden games and more Pandemic games as Matt is hard at work with so many things. You can always follow along with stuff that Matt is doing on Twitter at Matt Leacock. And we were just so thrilled to have him on the show. And I had said to him that, like, you know, it felt like a real Hail Mary pass to have him on the show in the first place, but I figured I would try to contact him anyway, and he came right back and was like, yeah, sure, I'll come on. Let's talk about cooperative games. And as always, make sure to go over to delvecast.com for more episodes of the show, the live episodes that we do. You might not have normally caught those. And all of the other projects that we have going on. We also have a Patreon going on right now, which has gone under a revamp. If you are a patron to our site, you can actually hear the raw, unedited version of this interview, which you may enjoy. It has a little bit of, you know, the banter before and afterward, everything else from that interview. So, it's interesting just to kind of see, you know, before I actually have an edited project, what it actually sounds like when people are just kind of talking. That Patreon has new levels as well at 1, 2, and 5. This is a lot different than the old one that we did just a few months ago that was supposed to make you smile, and now it's more serious. Still a lot of really good content there, and we are hoping to have some more good exclusive content, not just necessarily extended episodes that you normally get, but also some exclusive stuff that we really wouldn't have released elsewhere, but we really want somebody to hear it. So if you're a patron, even at the $1 level, there's going to be more stuff for you in the future. So you can also follow us on Twitter. I am at Citanium. Alex is at EXP Limited, and the show is at Delve Podcast. You can also follow us on Facebook. If you are on any podcast app, please rate, review, and subscribe when you happen to go see us. I love stars. I love shine getting. We would appreciate it a lot, and it helps for mysterious algorithms that very few people actually truly understand in iTunes. So I hope you enjoy how cooperative Alex and I were on this episode. It's a rare feat for us, but, you know, we have essentially been playing a 4-year-long cooperative game of our own by doing this show. I feel like it's really working out in our favor now. We've become experts at playing the game of Delve, and I hope all of you have enjoyed listening to it. And we will see you on the next one. Thank you for listening. It's terrific that you came on. You were kind of a Hail Mary pass for me. I contacted you like, I don't know. I'm going to try. I'll see if he'll come on. And then you responded. And I was like, oh, my God. Okay. Great.
Yeah. Nathan's had this list for a little while of people. He's like, these are people I'd love to get on eventually, and you were one of them. So he's excited.
Oh, that's great.
Absolutely. But we won't keep you any longer. You need to get back to those, like, dozen games you got to work on.
Yeah, I do.